Shop girls, railway men, servants, tobacco workers, sharecroppers, greedies. I am the black worker. Listen that the land might be ours. In the mines and factories of the office towers at Harlan, Richmond, Gastonia, Atlanta, New Orleans, that the plants and the roads and the tools of power be ours. Let us become instead, you and I, one single hand that can united rise to smash the old dead dogmas of the past, kill the lies of color that keep the rich enthroned and drive us to time clock and plow, helpless, stupid, scattered, and alone as now. Let us new lessons learn, all workers, new life ways make. One union form until the future burns out every past mistake. Let us together say, you are my brother.
Yo, como tú, amo el amor, la vida, el dulce encanto de las cosas, el paisaje celeste de los días de enero. También mi sangre bulle y río por los ojos que han conocido el brote de las lágrimas. Creo que el mundo es bello, que la poesía es como el pan de todos, y que mis venas no terminan en mí, sino en la sangre unánime de los que luchan por la vida, el amor, las cosas, el paisaje y el pan, la poesía de todos.
That house to which all other houses and the stories above them are compared. How much more different to remember a feeling when the land you walk is not named, and other winds seek you out like a flute. I was told to learn the songs of other places, to build a life that passes not in simile, but as firmament for a future spring. Married again to the blossom tree that knows the heart of a child, that distant field to which we are gathered is like another's child, whom we love like a hope. The latifundista could not know how everything moves upon the black ring we wear like the small dark nights of earth, tracing a common inheritance with our palm. More than home, more than material, is the knowledge to arrive closely, to sound in hungers, to land cherished like a craft. Always to this dream. And I forget to love the ocean when I forget to long for you.
Popular, muda na sociedade. All power to the people.
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 So what everyone just witnessed is what we call a mystica, which is a cultural edutainment performance designed to symbolize the struggle and the symbolic points that we emphasize here with, in regards to the MST. So everybody give yourselves a round of applause. Thank you everyone for participating. Please go ahead and take your seats. So this is the, we're going to talk a little bit more about a mystica later, but this is the second MST report back from the 6th Congress on Agrarian Reform. Before we go a little bit more detailed into that, we think it's important to recognize those that came before us, as well as always remember in this fight for liberation that we're fighting against colonialism, imperialism, and a lot of these other things. This place here is called Berkeley now, but to some it's also known as the land of the Ohlone people. So yeah. I'm going to introduce a brother from the Ohlone tribe as well as a member of Occupy the Farm, Brother Hank, who's going to share a little with y'all about the land that we're on right now. Give him a round of applause.
Creator, grandmother, grandfather, great-grandmother, great-grandfather, aunties and uncles, children. Creator, we thank you for the blessing of this land, land which our people have occupied for 10,000 years, land which others took and which we now struggle to regain and to liberate for the purposes that we traditionally use the land to accomplish, to sustain ourselves and to steward the land. We welcome all of you here. We thank you for being here and supporting us and being our brothers and our sisters and our allies. And we hope you never forget whose land you walk on. And we hope that the institutions of this city and this county and this state always remember where they took the land from and the people they took the land from. When people say this is our land, this is our land. And we need to honor it, and we need to have the ability to steward it together outside of the legal frameworks which took it away from us. So to the spirits of the West and the East and the North and the South, Father, Son, and Mother Earth, and to heart and spirit, blessings, thank you, and let's have a good evening.
All power to the people!
All power to the people!
Alright, so before I get a little bit further into it, y'all know I'm famous for this. This is Northern California, Berkeley. So whenever you hear me in particular say all power to the people, you're not going to get to slide away with a half-assed all power to the people. So when you hear me say all power to the people,
all power to the people!
Y'all catching up? That was your cue though. So you know, next time be ready because, yeah, I'm not going to be so nice. I'm also going, before we get even further into it, introduce someone who's very critical to this particular trip. Well, just the history of the Friends of the MST, which was responsible for sponsoring myself, Comrade Effie, and many other people to actually go to the Congress. He's also very involved here with La Pena. I want y'all to give a strong revolutionary hand clap for Eric
Leeson.
Give him a round of applause.
Sorry to say something so mundane after such a beautiful, eloquent talk, but the bathrooms are over there, between those doors, and over in the other room as well, back towards the back. Now, I want to welcome you here on behalf of La Peña. I am on the board of La Peña. In June, we'll be celebrating 39 years. I'd like to think that this institution has had some influence in creating several generations of people that really share revolutionary ideas and solidarity ideas. We started in direct response to the military coup in Chile. 1 year to the day after the military coup in Chile, we organized to be able to create solidarity and resistance to that military. Over the years, many different groups have really used this as a center for their activities. We've been very open. For many, many years, the AIM people, the Native American Indian movement, used this center regularly for un-Thanksgivings, on Thanksgiving Day and on other kinds of educational projects. Cesar Chavez celebrated his 50th birthday here in this room back in 77, I believe it was. So there's a long history, but one of the areas that I'm really most proud of has been the relationship between La Peña and the MST. We have really been moved here in the Bay Area by what the MST has done over the years. And unfortunately, over the last 15 to 20 years, we've had many, many MST leaders come through here and give talks and get people engaged in what's going on there. So I really want to thank the people who are putting on the report back tonight to let us know what's happening. And then I was in Brazil myself. I didn't get to go to the Congress. I was there just after that. But I was there with a delegation of 10 Cubans who were there to learn about how cooperatives are working in Brazil because, as you may know, Cuba is changing its economic model and opening up to much more cooperatives and other forms of enterprise that aren't only those run by the state. They could have a social, mission attached to them. So I had the experience of spending 2 days at the MST school with the Cubans. And it was a very moving experience because in the morning we would have the Mystica as we raised the flags. And they would talk about how important, the MST would talk about how important the Cuban Revolution was for them. How they looked at how the Cubans supported their work over time. And it was a very emotional experience. And as I'm sure we'll hear tonight, the solidarity that goes back and forth between these different groups is crucial. Otherwise, it couldn't really happen. So to conclude, I'm just going to put a little plug in. I'm going to be giving a talk here next Tuesday night, the 22nd, on the changes taking place in the Cuban economy, which is an area that I've been working in a lot. It's free. If anyone would like to come, it will be here at 7:30. So thank you all for coming to La Peña.
All power to the people.
All power to the people.
Okay, you're learning. I like that, so I can work with you. Also, before we get into the presentation, which I know you're all anxious to see, there's a couple people here that I want to acknowledge and make sure that, you know, this is a team effort, even though a few of us were able to go. A lot of people put in work to be able to allow it to go. Of course, our folks here are from Occupy the Farm, who Conrad Effie is a part of. Go ahead, give them a round of applause. They'll talk a little bit later on about that, about occupying land that's being not used by UC Berkeley and liberating it back for the benefit of the food sovereignty movement. Also, definitely want to give a round of applause to the Friends of the MST, who Brother Eric spoke about. They were very... very excellent hosts and bring us to the Congress and let us know how things went down. Of course, I'm a member of the Black Riders Liberation Party, who you see here close at the table. And there were also other people in the crowd that went with us. So I'm sure they'll probably have something to say a little bit later on, but I want y'all to give a round of applause for Charlotte, who was also on the trip with us. So with that being said, y'all ready to learn about the landless workers movement in Brazil?
Yeah!
Are you sure?
Yeah!
All power to the people?
All power to the people!
Right on. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Becky Terlow, who with the Friends of the MST, was one of our translators there and was an excellent comrade who helped us with the process of the Congress and a lot of the ins and outs with the different struggles and stuff going on in Brazil. So give Becky a round of applause.
Woo-hoo! Thanks, Shango, for that great introduction. And I don't know if you knew, we were going crazy over here because it was only a few seconds ago that the PowerPoint started working. So a round of applause for technology. So it's really an honor to be in front of all of you today and talking about the landless workers movement and the contemporary struggle for agrarian reform in Brazil. And we're going to talk mostly about the contemporary context, but before we get to the contemporary context, I was going to talk a little about the history of the movement. And it's quite a challenge to talk about the history of the landless workers movement, because although the movement started in the early 1980s, the movement is really a product of 500 years of landlessness and land concentration. And so I really can't start talking about the movement before I talk about that history. See, I said it was working, but now. Yeah, so they're going to try to find a map because on my computer, for some reason, it's like you're at an electro festival. But that's okay. You can understand that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. So again, the history of the Brazilian landless workers movement is really a history of 500 years of landlessness and land concentration. And to understand this, you really have to go back to the 1500s and understand that when the Portuguese colonized the Brazilian territory, they created a type of land grant system called Sesmarias, where literally they took all of Brazil, divided it between 12 parts, and gave 12 Portuguese colonial captains control over all of that land to do what they wanted with. And that system basically stayed in place until Brazilian independence in 1822. And so when Brazilian independence happened, this land was supposed to be returned to the Brazilian citizens. It was literally called Terra de Valuta, returned land. However, instead of returning this land to the Brazilian citizens, rural elites were able to find creative ways to actually grab this land and create false land deeds, using cricket blood to make these land deeds look old. And so instead of this land from the colonial era being redistributed to the Brazilian citizens, these colonial elites were able to maintain that land. Another reason why landlessness is a really big issue in Brazil is the history of slavery. Brazil had the largest slave trade in the Americas, and this was primarily due to the sugarcane economy. By the 16th century, I think 70% of the labor on plantations were black Africans who were brought over as slaves. And so Brazil only actually ended slavery in 1888. They were the second to last country in the Americas to end slavery. And after this happened, most of those slave descendant populations stayed landless. So that was another huge issue for the landlessness. Another big issue was the first land law was in 1850, and this first land law actually made it finally legal to buy land. But instead of allowing landless people to buy land, it actually facilitated the consolidation of large landed properties, and it also made sure that people who had been previously squatting on land, in other words, they didn't own the land, but they were sort of using it, it made them not able to do that anymore. And so that increased land concentration as well. Then you have, from the 1870s and the 1900s, you have a big push to bring European immigrants, mostly German and Italian immigrants, over to Brazil to sort of populate the southern part of the country and to whiten the country, because the Brazilian rural elite and urban elite were very scared that now they had brought all these slaves in, they had sort of a darker population. And so they brought these German Italians in, and although some of these Germans and Italians maintained control over, got actually small plots of land, the majority of them also remained landless. So even among sort of the immigrant European population, you have a huge issue of landlessness in Brazil. Luckily, people never... Sorry, are you switching over?
Yep, we got it.
Perfect. Although I didn't mind the electro bit that much.
All right, I'm going to choose...
We're right there on that slide.
Yeah.
Yep.
Does this work with that?
There we go.
Yeah. Woo! Okay. Do you need me on this? I'm good. I can do this. No, but I'm okay. Do you guys hear me when I talk?
Yeah.
I don't need a camera. or microphone. Okay, so I'm quickly moving through history. We went from the 1500s to the 1800s to the 1900s. And so you have this history of land concentration and landless, but luckily people don't just let this happen to them. People are always and continually resisting. And specifically in the 1940s and the 1950s, the countryside of Brazil was going crazy. There were peasant leagues, there were rural unions, there was mobilizations all over Brazil, and they were all calling for what's called agrarian reform, a massive redistribution of land concentration to landless people. And so the pressure was getting so big, and it really looked like in the early 1960s that Brazil was finally, after 500 years of land concentration, was going to redistribute that land to the landless people. But what happened? Why didn't that happen? Military dictator. You guys need a Brazilian history. Huh? It's good thing I'm going over this. So right when it looked like the Brazilian population was eventually going to get the land that they deserved, a dictatorship took place in 1964. And this dictatorship lasted 20 years. And people were jailed and people were killed. And almost all political organizing basically had to go underground. Now, along with the military dictatorship came... I'll tap you when you go.
Yeah, okay, cool. And I'm pushing it down, but...
Yeah. But along with military dictatorship came growth. The 20-year period of the military dictatorship was a huge amount of growth, where between 1968 and 1974, the economy grew at an average yearly rate of 10 to 11%. This is humongous. And everyone embraced it, and it was called an economic miracle. But I think when we talk about growth and we talk about GDP growth specifically, we always have to ask the question, growth for who? And so is this really an economic miracle? Another statistic that's interesting is while in 1960 the richest 10% of the population received 39.6% of the national income, the same population received 50.9% of the national income by 1980. In other words, the Brazilian economic miracle didn't bring people out of poverty, but it increased the divide between rich and poor over those 20 years. Meanwhile, in the countryside, you have what's called a big push for agricultural modernization, what people will call the Green Revolution. Again, this is one of those trick words too, right? Agricultural modernization. It sounds like we're pushing the countryside forward and the countryside's progressing. But what happens with the Green Revolution and the agricultural modernization is that you have a huge push for monoculture, intensive monoculture, and intensive use of pesticides, which causes huge environmental degradation. Currently, this is a crazy statistic. Currently in Brazil, Brazilians consume the most pesticides of any country in the entire world. That's how much pesticide is in their food. So you have these huge public health issues. And as for the rural population that was resisting before, what happened to them? A lot of them were pushed into the cities. So in 1940, less than 32% of the population lived in cities. But by 1991, 70% of Brazil's population is urban. People are flocking to the cities during this period of economic miracle and urban growth. And you get this. You get this contradiction where there's this huge industrial development in the cities and these humongous slums and favelas on the outskirts of the cities, and you have a huge increase in urban poverty. Luckily, what do people always do?
Resist,
right? So, go ahead. So also in the late 1970s, you get your first sort of wink of political opening. The military dictatorship doesn't take quite as hard line against people. And you have the first sort of urban labor union actions. And this in the late 1970s is the moment when the future president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who's this guy right here, who eventually becomes president, this is when he starts becoming famous. He starts organizing these large urban, these large strikes in auto factories. And this is also the moment that the Workers' Party, this is famous now, right? The Workers' Party, the PT, has been in power in Brazil for 12 years now. But this is the moment, still during the military dictatorship, that the Workers' Party, the PT, is founded. So that's your history. Now we can get to the MST. And I'll go quickly through it. Good. So the first land occupations in Brazil happened during this political moment, during the birth of the Workers' Party, during the birth of the oppositional labor movement. And the first land occupation that led to the founding of the MST in 1984 happened in 1979. And it's actually a really interesting story, because it's a story of how, when resources are scarce, poor populations are pitted against each other. We know that always happens, right? So in this state, in Huron de Sul, there were a lot of landless farmers that didn't have anywhere to farm. And so slowly they started moving into an indigenous reservation, the Kangang Indians that were living in that area. And for 10 years they kept moving in. And by 1978, 8,000 landless families were living in this indigenous reservation. And the indigenous people were not happy. And they were telling the authorities, and the authorities weren't doing anything, because it's better your problem than our problem, right? And so eventually the indigenous population declared war on these landless families and said, you gotta get out. And they picked up arms. And so the landless families are pushed out of this indigenous reserve. And basically at this point in 1979, they felt like they had no other options. And they were also connected with a bunch of radical priests within the Catholic Church. And they were encouraged to occupy a large plantation in that area that was privately owned, but was not being used productively. And so these families occupied it. Again, this is during the period of military dictatorship still, right? They occupied this land, and the dictator, decided to actually redistribute this land to those families and allow them to live on it. Soon, in the next few years, lots of more occupations happened of private land during the 1980, 1981, 82, 83, and this tactic of land occupation was very successful, even before democracy returned to Brazil. So eventually, these dispersed landless occupations of landless peasants decided to come together. This was in 1984. They came together and decided to create a united movement. Now, there were lots of influences on the ability of these peasants to organize occupations, right? The Workers' Party was influential, Communist Party was influential, the radical priests in the Catholic Church were influential. However, at this meeting in 1984, the MST decided that they were going to be an autonomous organization. They weren't going to have an affiliation with the church, with a party, or with a union. And so they were an autonomous organization, and they were going to call, their phrase, which is cut off there, is land for those that work on it. Okay. Over the past 30 years, right, this is 2014 now, so this is actually the 30th anniversary of the MST this year. 1.5 million women, men, and children have gotten land rights. That's over 350,000 families have actually gotten land through MST occupations. I'll just fly through this really quickly. Part of the reason why the MST has been so successful is that there's a clause in the 1988 Brazilian Constitution that says that land has to serve a social function. And it literally says, look here, it says that the Brazilian government, a constitution requires the Brazilian government to expropriate for the purpose of agrarian reform rural property that is not performing its social function. It's required. It never does it unless people occupy land. Let me just put that out there. But it's actually required by the Constitution. I think it's important to remember, though, that this law came in 1988, and the occupations that were initially successful were happening before this law, right? So this constitutional law was sort of a result of those MST land occupations. Here you can see just the scope of landless occupations that have happened between 1988 and 2011, a lot of them in the Central West and the Northeast. A really interesting comparison, if you look, that's the map of occupations, and this is a map where families are actually settled onto land, and you can see that there's very few occupations in the Amazon. That's a region of other struggles, indigenous struggles, the struggles of the anti-dam movement. However, the government has tried to settle the majority of people who occupy land into the Amazonian region, right? And this is an explicit government tactic to quell land conflict by pushing landless families onto land that's less valuable and that might actually be indigenous territory, in all honesty, and not have them try to fight for this more expensive, better land in the Central West and the South. And so that map's really interesting. Those comparisons are really interesting there. Finally, I just have to talk a little bit about today. It's April 17th. It has a huge significance because although the MST has been successful in its struggle in a lot of ways, the price of resistance has been huge. Over since 1985, when the country became a democracy again, 1,742 people, mostly peasant activists, have been killed in agrarian conflicts. It's a lot of people. Less than 3% of these cases have ever been brought to trial. So one of the most egregious examples of this violence in the countryside happened on April 17th, 1996, and it's called the Massacre of El Dorado de Carajás. It was in the state of Pará, in the Amazon, in the right outside the Amazonian region. The MST had a march of 1,500 people, and they were trying to block a road in order to force the government to implement agrarian reform. And at 4 p.m. on April 17th, 1996, 155 state military police from two brigades surrounded the MST on the highway, began to fire tear gas, as well as live ammunition from rifles and machine guns. 19 landless people were killed instantly. Two died later from injuries, and 69 were wounded. This is why April 17th has been declared the International Day of Peasant Resistance. In Brazil, it's called Red April. It's a month where the MST organizes hundreds of landless occupations. This happens to be an occupation that I actually was part of on April 17th, 2011, about 3 years ago. And I think as we move forward to the contemporary context, it's really important to acknowledge that today is April 17th, and over the past 12 hours, there's been dozens and dozens and dozens of MST land occupations throughout Brazil over the past 12 hours.
Thanks everybody for being here today. Thank you, Becky, for introducing us. What's up, Red April? Today is also, I just want to put one word out, today is the birthday of Steve Rawlings, who passed away 2 years ago, and it's my dad. So this one's for you. This is a picture from the MST Congress where we went. You can see the big arena there, which held thousands and thousands of people. 15,000 people from around the country came to participate in this Congress. So why put so many resources into this event? It was a mobilization of 15,000 leaders, as I said, held in the nation's capital of Brasilia. And they gathered there to celebrate their 30th year of struggle, and it was the culmination of 2 years of discussion and debate from the bottom up. So from the grassroots level, from the núcleo, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later, which is the small affinity groups of people within camps and settlements, debating and discussing the future of the movement, this moved up to the national level, where the future of the movement and the new slogan and the sort of analysis of the current political moment was created and celebrated here at this event. So you can see that they put out all these big tents, brought lots of food to share with one another, just camped out, occupation style. Looks a little bit familiar, right? Yeah. So there were large groups from each state of Brazil representing camps and settlements that they lived in there, and they sat together inside of, so you can see here, kitchens, also might look a little familiar, and people representing each state of Brazil. So the next slide, you can see some folks from the Amazon, and each state has a very unique feel and culture, and that was apparent in the slogans and the chants that people shared with the assembly. Periodically, a state would kind of just seize a moment and start doing a chant or a song, and they'd have their own visuals. It was kind of a window into their culture. So, for example, like a deep and complex drum beat started one time, and somebody leans over to me and they're like, oh, that's Bahia. So Bahia, just a little bit from their history, they were the center of Brazil's sugar industry since the 16th century, and more than 37% of all slaves that were taken from Africa moved through Bahia. through Brazil, mostly to be processed and then sent to work in plantations elsewhere in the country. And so that African heritage was very tangible any time that we heard from Bahia. And little glimpses like that of other regions' histories were when they were represented to the larger assembly. So it was also a time of focused political education for the movement, space, particularly in terms of launching that new political program. So there were large discussions held in this arena and also smaller panels of group meetings in other areas. Topics included subjects specific to gender, tactical strategies for the year, analyses of current political climate, and historical context. So the MST feels like moments like these are some of the most important for any social movement because it's a space to re-energize members as well as integrate new people and... So it's a place to re-energize members and allies and help to mobilize more people in the face of fierce criminalization by local oligarchies and their international allies of agribusiness, which Becky was talking about just a moment ago. It's a reminder that the MST is still going strong and can disrupt business as usual in a big way, which we'll hear more about when Shago talks about the march. So the Congress is a space to remember, realize, affirm, and strategize for the future. As one speaker said on the first day, identity is a reason to fight. Memory is a vaccine against death.
Great. And just before we move on to the role of the U.S. delegation, I just want to say that one of the most important parts of the 6th MST Congress is that the MST launched a new agrarian reform program that they're calling now the People's Agrarian Reform. We have it translated into English here. As MST activists explained countless times during the Congress, in the classical agrarian reform model, you can have some agrarian reform and you can have some small farming, but that is not the principal thing that's driving the economy is an urban industrial primary agricultural export model, right? And so those two things live together simultaneously. And this new people's agrarian reform model, it's an attempt to completely transform the entire mode of production in the countryside. The MSC says that this new type of agrarian form is necessary because they don't have the same enemy they used to have. Their enemy used to be the rural oligarch descendants of the Portuguese colonialists who were just sitting with tons of land and not using it, right? That was their enemy. Now the MST says their enemy is different. Their enemy is the transnational corporations. It's Monsanto. It's Cargill. And we're clapping, but the MST faces a big problem because the Brazilian population was very supportive of them when their enemy was these rural oligarchs who weren't using their land. They're very much less supportive now that MST is trying to contest modern agricultural production. And so the MST has realized that in order to win the struggle, it needs to create more alliances with urban populations. One quote from this agrarian reform program says, "This type of agrarian reform now depends on a consolidated alliance between the peasants and all urban workers. Alone, the landless will never achieve people's agrarian reform." So we have about 7 copies of these in English that we're going to pass around. People can skim through as we're doing the rest of our presentation. We'd like them back at the end. However, if you're with a community organization or a social movement or a group that thinks you'll put one of these into purpose, which it's great. It gives an entire sort of 500-year history of global agrarian change and talks about the current political conjuncture. So if you think you can put that to use, talk to us afterwards, and we could probably get you a copy. So, yeah, can you pass this out? Okay, so now I'm going to hand it back over to Shango to talk about the role of the U.S. delegation in the Congress.
Okay, so there was... multiple objectives that we had, one as the international delegation. So basically the international delegation had about, I think, over 250 people from different places like Cuba, Venezuela, Haiti, from I think even China and a bunch of other places from around the world. And we went as members in the Bay, or people in the Bay Area from the United States delegation to go over there to basically learn about what's going on, as well as find ways that we could critique and gain from what the work that the MST had been doing. Obviously, it's a 30-year movement. There's millions of people involved with it, and they've won a lot of more gains for food sovereignty, I believe, than we have over here, so we have a lot to learn from. So prior to going, we held a community forum at the Quilombo. Some of you are familiar with that space, an autonomous space in West Oakland, where we held a lot of community meetings and a lot of different things for radical spaces and organizing. So people came to basically tell us what they needed from us going on this trip to learn to be able to bring back here to try to help push not just the food sovereignty movement, but, you know, movement against imperialism, against capitalism, against poverty and oppression in general. We were hit with many questions regarding tactics involved engaging with the state, picking up arms, as well as a bunch of other different things in international solidarity. So we went out there and to investigate the concerns the community had prior to going. Also, as being sponsored by the MST, we were invited as people who are involved with social justice movements, because they didn't want people to be able to go over there to try to slum it for some street cred in Brazil activists. They wanted people who were going to come back here and not only, you know, raise awareness about what they have going on, but also help implement, because the struggle is connected between what's going on in Brazil and what's going on internationally, especially here in the United States, which is the nervous center for capitalist imperialism. So that was some of our objectives. Myself personally also had a few objectives as a representative of the Black Riders Liberation Party to go over and inform people in Brazil, which has a large African population, especially in the northeast section in Bahia, about what's going on with people over here. Things like the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement report of black people getting killed every 28 hours this past year by a member of law enforcement or some type of fiduciary security force, fake wannabe vigilante Zimmerman. My mission was to go over there and inform them of the struggles that we have over here, see where we can build more principled solidarity, as well as gain international connections for not only my organization, but for the African Liberation Movement worldwide and the People's Liberation Movement worldwide. So, yeah, that's a picture of us there. At our section, we had a little section, the international section. Like I said, there was people from Venezuela, Cuba, all over, Mexico, Peru, a lot of different places. So it was basically to build principled solidarity with the struggles going on in Brazil, Latin America, the world, here with the people fighting against oppression in the United States.
Cool. So what we're going to do now is Effie, Shango, and I got together after the Congress, and we sort of came up with different themes that we thought were important. So we're going to have like almost like a speed dating, go through like each theme really quickly. And if you want to know more afterwards, we can talk more afterwards in the question and answer session. So Effie's going to start off talking about our visit to an actual MST camp settlement and pre-settlement before the Congress.
Cool. Thank you. So we got there a week early. So that we could visit some of these spots where people are actually living and fighting for land. This is the van that we spent many hours in, and some of the delegates are there. Shango's looking a little unsure there. Maybe he is sure of some. So this is some of the landscape that we passed through. We were in Goiás, which I'm mispronouncing, but it's an area, a rural area that's near Brasilia, and that's why we went there, was because it was near the capital where the Congress was happening. And the next slide, you can see that it looks a lot like the Midwest in a lot of parts, with long, huge swaths of corn, soy, and sugarcane. Of course, we don't have sugarcane in the Midwest, but the rest we do. And a lot of that has to do with a lot of the government policies that have happened over the last couple of decades. A lot of investment, government investment in sugarcane for ethanol, that sort of thing. Go to the next one. So when on our way to the camp, we stopped at a camp first, which is an occupation. So there's settlement, which the land's been won, and there's camp, which is an occupation. It's pretty hard to find these things. They're way out there. So we had to stop and ask for directions a couple times. But then we finally found it. There it is. You can see the road over here on the right, and this is kind of like in a little hollow there next to the road. So this is not the land that they're fighting for. This is some neutral ground about 30 kilometers away from the agricultural land that they're fighting for, which is some of the best in the country. And they're kind of gathering and preparing to go back for their third occupation, their third attempt at occupying this space. They've been doing occupying that space for 4 years. And that's pretty typical. It's not an easy thing. So there are 180 families in this particular camp. They took us to the tent where they gather for large group discussions several times every single week. And they brought us there. You can see the MST flag at the front. The guy in the white t-shirt below the MST flag is the kind of the head of strategy and the camp, Antonio Carlos. They fed us immediately as soon as we got there. They really got a lot of things nailed down in terms of cooking and water. Introduced us to their children, to their families. That young man, his name is William, and his baby's name is Victor, 9 months old, and he's talking about how his son's destiny is intertwined with that of the camp. Families, children. This is a single mom and her two daughters and one of the elder women of the camp, and so families are a huge, huge part. The next slide shows some of the water system that they've got going on there. Well, Shango having a go. Go on to the next one. And it's kind of an interesting mix of modern and traditional technologies that you see in the camp. This guy's showing us his horse-drawn carriage and some pigs. So they're there. That's just their sort of mustering camp, right? But they're still doing it. They're farming every day. They're keeping their animals. They're growing food. Vilma's telling us about some of the trees that are growing there. That's a rubber tree that's not quite ready to be harvested. But she's telling us about what a joke some of the reforestation programs are, because really they'll cut down native forest and they'll replant a cash crop tree. So something like eucalyptus or rubber. So she's kind of informing us. And this is really common that people have a pretty nuanced understanding of politics and ecology and what's happening with larger political struggles, global struggles. This is what the MST is really. We got there and someone said, "Oh, this is Camp Makarenko," and we're like, "Who's Makarenko?" Turns out it's some Soviet philosopher that had some educational breakthroughs and on education, and this is kind of like a cognitive dissonance for me, right? Like going there and seeing the super rural context, but referring to some pretty advanced philosophy, and that's really like what the MST is. It's kind of a marriage of the philosophy and the working with the hands every day. Okay, one little diversion here. This guy was really excited to show this weapon of the landless to us. It's a bunch of tin cans that are kind of glued together, and then there's a slit at the bottom, and they put in gasoline and or some sort of rubbing alcohol and shake it like this for a while, and then hold it and light the slit at the bottom, and it makes this huge boom, like a gun or like a firework. And this is used during like an active occupation to let folks know, like, kind of like 12 o'clock and all's well sort of thing, like letting everybody know that people are up, letting whoever might be out there mustering to attack that they're up and they're active. And they even let the kids, you know, do these things as well and let keep the sound going. Some more pictures of discussions. We had some really amazing discussions thanks to Gustavo, who you see there in the white t-shirt, and Becky, who did an amazing amount of translating. We were really able to sit down and connect with people. And in the evening, they put on a dance for us. You can see there's a couple on the left there that I'm going to talk about a little bit later when we talk about gender and sexuality. They were a huge part of the camp, really a strong couple that was holding things down in a big way. And when we asked about sexuality, people said, "Oh yeah, well, we have a gay couple here."
They're part of our community.
And introduced us to those folks, and they definitely were integrated and a really big part of the community. Those are their daughters there, too, in the pink. Yeah, and this is when the dance floor got too hot, they water it. So we only got to stay there for one night, but it was an amazing exchange. And at the end, they presented us with these little handmade gifts that they had done for that occasion. And Becky's getting a little doll there, and everybody's really really valuing that moment and having the opportunity to get to know each other a little bit. Shango also offered a performance of a hip-hop piece, and people were very appreciative of that as well.
Stay tuned for
Yeah, you'll see some more of that live tonight. I offered some of the handmade bandanas that I had brought from Occupy the Farm, and they said, well, this is a flag that we're going to treat like ours, and they hung it up, and they said they'd be sending us so much love and strength in all the actions that we're doing going forward as well. Yeah. The next thing we went to was a pre-settlement. So this was land that had just been won legally, and people were deciding how they were going to use it. And it's really impressive to hear statistics like the MST has reclaimed 2 million acres over the last 30 years. But it's important to know that only 10% of their attempts are successful. And most of the time, it's at least 5-year struggle. So this gentleman and his son, who's in the next slide, were just getting their house set up. Every single one of those bricks that you see there, they built themselves. They had some amazing intercropping going on with bananas and peanuts and squash and pumpkins that they were very happy to show the chicken. And really welcomed us into their home and showed us how they live every day. This is their home there, getting it all set up. And this farmer met us at his gate and was also very welcoming and happy that people were coming out and seeing the space. They were establishing as well how they were going to manage the land, because there's always a encouragement of establishing a school and some sort of collective agriculture. So usually a grain collective is established for a large swath of land for many of the families that are there. Thank you. So I'll fly through this real quick. We also visited an established settlement that was seven years in the making. You can go next. Also got fed well. This is Mel. She's the militant organizer that worked with the MST through the last decade or so. This is a cooperative rice field, so it's managed by 90 families, 60 hectares. And then her son milking their cows. I'll just go quickly because I'm over the time already. This is Betsy, and she's been involved in the MST for over 20 years. She got involved as a very young woman and lives and works on one of the most successful collective farms that are part of the MST. On the next slide, you can see her house, which is part of a circle. All the land is collectively run and owned. And they had the right to divvy it up in the beginning, but they decided to do it all collectively, all cooperatively. So everything from the milking the cows, to working the rice fields, to cooking the collective lunch every day, to caring for the children gets organized collectively. And everyone gets paid the same, and everyone works 10 hours a day. So I'm going to move on to culture now. Thanks,
Jago. So, Emil Carl Cabral, who's a member of the African Liberation Movement, says that the basis of culture is economics, and what we mean by that is that, you know, it helps inspire people's ability to survive and thrive. So, this is from the MST website right here, or Friends of the MST website, that says, at demonstrations, marches, occupations, imprisonments, and commemorations of victories and conquests, music, poetry, and dance are presented, expressing and strengthening the Semtera cultural identity. So, as we talked earlier with the Mystica, it's a symbolic representation, usually of the topics of discussion, the theoretical viewpoints that they want to emphasize to people. Huey Newton would call it capturing the imagination of the people. Unfortunately, some of us don't necessarily read as thoroughly as we do. We need to in order to do what it is to we need to do to be free. But culture and inspiration can help people gain the discipline necessary to advance and continue on. So this was a very significant part of the entire Congress. So about out of 5 days straight, every morning, the Congress would start at about 8 o'clock, I would say, with the Mishnica. And throughout the course of the day, and usually, always in the stadium, the big stadium, but there were also workshops on, you know, the outskirts of the stadium. They would begin the topic of discussion, the workshop, the debate, or whatever it was, with the Mishnica that was relevant to whatever they were going to be discussing.
We transformed the stadium format, but you can see the Mishnica here. We can talk about this. I'll go around.
So, yeah, there's strong symbolism throughout the whole Mishnicas and culture. They would have big props with tools that they would use with their farming, tools that they would use. There was this one Mishnica that had big pillars of like different things like globalization, it would say religious fundamentalism, agribusiness, and a bunch of other things that were contributing to the oppression of the people. And it would be a bunch of people start to swarm it with, you know, fake rocks, slingshots, tools, whatever, and the symbolism was that the masses of people would crush this one connected entities that was oppressing them all. So symbolism within the Mishnica was very vital, and the things usually lasted plenty of hours. So during the course of the day, if you expect somebody to sit there from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night listening to, you know, theoretical discussion about, you know, a lot of things that are complicated with citations that some of us haven't read yet, the symbolism of the Mishnicas usually would keep you inspired and wanting more and not saying, oh, when is the food or when is the, you know, whatever, you know. So the Mishnicas were very crucial in keeping the Congress upbeat. And they were also very class conscious. Every Mishnica had to do with the oppressed fighting back against the elites. Usually it would be very specific. Monsanto, other different people that are specific enemies of the people. So, yeah, I thought that was very cool, and I thought that was very important, you know, to incorporate culture in aspects of the struggle for people to find different ways to get inspired. And also that we learned that the purpose of the Mishnicas was to bridge the gap between the intellectual and the aesthetic or the artistic. So, you know, it would bring the theoretical concepts to those who might be more receptive to the artistic symbolism and make them seem to be intertwined as opposed to opposites, you know. So art and culture is not the enemy of intellectual, you know, study and vice versa. So that was what we learned is the purpose of the Mishnicas and culture in general. So
cool. All right. This is my little sketch here. Please forgive the hand-drawn action there. But I was trying to draw a few sketches so that we could understand the structure of the MST. That was one of the things I was most interested in learning about, was how do people work together and organize themselves. So these are the various sectors of work, and you can kind of follow the evolution of the movement as you look at how things have kind of specialized. You might not be able to see there, human rights is actually law. There's a lot of legal support that's given to people within the movement. But you can check those out for yourself, and I'll tell you about another aspect, which is the organizers, the militants, they are called, which is a different connotation than the word in English. Militants are folks who have come up through the life cycle of an occupation themselves, of their own, and now dedicate a large portion of their lives, usually no pay, to the movement, to organizing every day. Most have received some degree of intensive political education on the ideologies of the MST called Formación. Okay, I'm gonna go off my own mind.
You got
here.
It.
Okay, great. Militants are usually help start a camp, but sometimes they're not around. There's actually more demand. There's more people that want to be part of occupations than there are organizers to help organize them. So There's camps that are flying the MST flag and trying to adopt this structure by just kind of osmosis and talking to other people without any sort of official organization from trained organizers. So down at the bottom you'll see there is the nucleo, which I mentioned earlier. This is what we might call an affinity group. So families that get together and share information between each other and are self-selected. Two people from each nucleo, which you can see are represented by the little colored dots and squares, move into the coordinating collective. So this is like the kind of strategic decision-making body of a camp or a settlement. And the different colors are supposed to be representing the different sectors, because ideally you've got every sector represented in the coordinating collective. So you've got all the different perspectives from the different work groups that are going on. And then there's a square, which is supposed to represent a male, and a circle, which is supposed to represent a woman, because there needs to be one of each coming from each nucleo. The women had to fight for that around 2005 to get that equal representation. And then that moves up to, as you can see, through each larger regional. So there's hundreds of regions in Brazil, up to the state, which I believe there's 26 states in Brazil, and then up to the national coordinating collective. So strategy starts in the nucleus. People start talking about things there. This is not only just an information sharing day to day, but also a place where people are talking about, as Becky and I keep saying, the conjecture, like the conjuncture, the climate. And so that's where things start. That's where ideas kind of mature and then move up into decision-making bodies. And oftentimes, if a coordinating collective can't figure things out, if they can't make a decision, they'll send it back down to the nucleo to talk about it some more and figure it out and then go back up and make a decision.
Okay, can Effie sit here so I can talk? Okay, so now I have been given, give me the hard ones, I've been given the task of explaining the MST's relationship to the Brazilian state, which is very polemic, and a lot of people get angry about social movements' relationship to the state. So I wrote it out, and I usually stop reading my paper and talk, but I'm going to try to read it because I want to be very clear about the MST's relationship to the state, because it gets critiqued a lot, perhaps with reason. So the MST was born, as I mentioned before in the history, during a moment of military dictatorship when social movements of all types and ideologies were united in calling for a return to democracy. This was perhaps the moment when the MST's relationship to the state was the most simple, right? There was a military dictatorship, they were organizing protests, they had different demands, and there was a clear line between the MST and the state. In addition, the MST got all its funding through the Catholic Church and through international solidarity organizations. And so this relationship was simple. However, this was also the moment that the Workers' Party, the party that's been in power in the federal level for the past 12 years, was born. In fact, the MST, the PT, and the oppositional union were born together. And these relationships between these activists that were born at the same moment continue to be very strong. You see ex-President Lula and President Dilma wearing MST hats. But you can stay on that one. But I want to say that even before the PT took power, in the 1990s, when you have what's called a neoliberal government, some people say it is, some people say it isn't, but you had an antagonistic government. Even when that antagonistic government was in power, the MST's relationship to the state began to get complicated. Because the MST, I just want to emphasize this, the MST is not the Zapatistas. Activists are not fighting for autonomy from the Brazilian state. They are fighting for the Brazilian state to fulfill its responsibility to the citizens of Brazil. For the MST, this includes the responsibility to provide education, healthcare, housing, infrastructure, agricultural technical assistance, and other public goods. So at the MST Congress, one of the leaders of the MST, João Paulo, talked to us about this relationship between the MST and the state. João Paulo said, "The first question to be clear on is the political nature of the MST. Some think of us as a big NGO or union, and some think of us as a political party. Our political nature has a lot of these elements, but we are a social movement, and our political nature is to negotiate with the government and to demand what our base needs. We have a responsibility to our base. He goes on to say, when we interact with the state and government, we are still a social movement. Why do we not break with the state or government? The NGOs can say that they do not receive money from the state. The NGOs can do this, but our movement cannot do this because we have a social base that has rights, and those rights are the responsibility of the government.
Yeah.
So, as John Paulo explains, the MSC believes it is necessary to negotiate with the government to win concrete material benefits for the populations living in areas of agrarian reform. They try to do this from a position of autonomy. This has created many interesting and complex situations. For example, in this picture, the MSC has succeeded to demand a public school for children living in its occupied illegal territories. And it has even gotten permission to bring this public school on marches with the movement so the children do not have to study. Thus, and I want to be clear, thus in this case, the state has actually become part of the mobilization of the social movement itself. State-society lines are clearly blurred. So, basically, at every government level, MSC activists have relationships with local politicians and try to demand concrete concessions from their settlement. In our own U.S. delegation, we learned this because when we went to visit a settlement in Guayas, the vice mayor came to see us, most likely thinking that 12 people from the United States in her community would give her some kind of political capital. Before she came, Mel, our host, gave us a list of 20 demands we were going to ask her for. When the vice mayor arrived, it was obvious to everyone that the relationship was very superficial. However, the MSC uses every moment like this as a chance to get concessions from their government for their base. Move on. Nonetheless, these relationships have gotten much more complicated since the Workers' Party took power at the federal level in 2003. The MSC has an official position of autonomy from political parties. It is not associated with any party. However, each election, the national, state, and regional MSC collectives do an analysis of political conjuncture, and they often campaign for people that they see as having been more committed to agrarian reform. They did this for the Workers' Party in 2003, in 2007, and 2010. However, the Workers' Party has not supported agrarian reform. It has continued with many of the previous government's market-based land reform, and it has settled a minimal, almost no families over the past decade. Nonetheless, the Workers' Party has created some concrete gains for poor populations in Brazil. Ever since the Workers' Party took power, the government has succeeded in lifting millions of people out of abject poverty through cash transfer programs like Bolsa Família and lots of other social benefits. The PT has also given more money and resources to MST settlements, not the camps, but MST settlements, than ever before. However, here we come, the government has primarily funded these projects through investment in export-oriented industrial agricultural production. The PT has a growing relationship with agribusiness, and in 2005, agribusiness exports, especially soy, oranges, sugar, made up 45% of Brazilian exports. This is the money that the Brazilian government uses to both pay off external debt and also fund these social programs that have literally lifted people out of poverty. So here's the contradiction. While the MST was previously funded by outside solidarity groups, it is now primarily funded through government programs in settlements, which the MST finds creative ways to utilize in their political struggle. In essence, the MST is funded by the same government that supports the expansion of agribusiness, which also threatens the future existence of the movement. This picture embodies the contradiction. Here you have President Dilma announcing a program that is going to give unprecedented funds to education in rural areas, theoretically based in the MSC's pedagogical approach. However, at the ceremony, both the MST is on stage, and Senator Cláudia Abreu, the most vocal proponent of agribusiness in the country, and infamous among the MST for her hatred of the movement. So what? So the MST acknowledges these contradictions, and it's trying to find ways to move forward in the struggle for socialism and against agribusiness by finding the gaps in the state that activists can take advantage of to move forward in their struggle. However, these MST-state relationships are not universally embraced by all activists. In fact, in 2011, about 50 activists actually left the movement because they were very critical of the MST's relationship with the state. Clearly, the movement will have to continue to reflect on these contradictions as it moves forward in the next period. So you don't have a firm conclusion on that relationship. All right. Now we're going to move on to gender and sexuality. Sean was going to...
So, gender, I was able to attend the... So throughout the course of the Congress, there was about four different panel debates, they called it, which was really a discussion and a presentation of the debates that had already happened within the MST organizing circles. And it was a presentation to the rest of the comrades and supporters about the conclusions and a lot of the ideas that they had come up with. So while sitting on the sitting in the stadium, listening to the panel discussion on gender within the MST movement, I basically took some notes and was able to emphasize on some key points that I felt that they were pointing out throughout the course of the debate. I'm gonna kind of speed through some of them because we're a little bit behind time. We can definitely dialogue some more during the course of the end with the discussion and the question and answer. But one quote that I found that all of the women that were on the panel emphasized was that there is no feminism without socialism, and that there is no socialism without feminism, that the women's struggle is a class struggle. The relationship to the means of production, as far as women are concerned, completely supports sexism and classism simultaneously. They were adamant about emphasizing that it was a class struggle and that capitalism causes these different dynamic relationships with men and women and gender inequality. So in the 80s, women were considered important oftentimes because, well, in the males, the patriarchal male perspective, that because they were able to convince their husbands to either not join the movement out of fear for them losing their job. And a lot of the women in the movement felt this was degrading to be put into this position as just some type of deterrent for their husbands or, being seen as their male comrades, lovers, as opposed to important comrades within the movement. A lot of the women emphasized consistently that women were a part of the entire 30-year struggle throughout the MST, but this Congress that we attended was the first time that there was a debate and panel discussion about it. So the women who pushed for this to be able to be there definitely were proud of the struggles that they had accomplished to be able to get it on the agenda. At the same time, weren't satisfied as if this was some type of end to gender inequality or sexism. So they also just said that the discussion of gender equality is not enough to debate in the Congress, but we must make it effective and naturalized within the movement, which includes public policies and food sovereignty and energy for women and to protect women's rights within that struggle. So there was also interesting, I felt like, difference of perspectives with the three women. And I have the notes of the names. I don't have it on this paper right here. But there was three women in particular. One woman was obviously indigenous. The two other women were fair skinned. I'm not sure of their specific ethnicity. Heavy emphasis on the indigenous woman was to not only just say that women can accomplish the same roles as men and should be offered the same opportunities, but we should not degrade the people, the women who, out of their own strength, decided to hold together household and domestic work. And it shouldn't be something that people are talked about as in, these are, oh, well, you're just being oppressed as opposed to we should honor the agency of these women who, in spite of the struggles of capitalism and sexism and patriarchy, were able to still hold a family together and continue to struggle in a revolutionary manner. And I noticed that that's from, you know, as a from a privileged perspective as a male, that's a constant discussion within the contemporary feminism or discussion here in the United States as well. Oftentimes, women of color have issues with European-descended women trying to direct the struggle as something other than what they've already been doing indigenously prior to colonization as well. You know, being able to not necessarily see a separate role as something demeaning, but something all part of the balanced picture that is necessary. And she emphasized, the indigenous woman, that we need to not only offer more opportunities for women to participate in every single level, from leadership on down, but also to honor the women who have been considered traditional roles as not something that was just demeaning, but also something that should be honored for being able to do that. And also, it should be respected. And I feel like a quote for that was that women have to struggle for the right to work in a dignified manner in domestic labor as well. The personal is political, and what happens in the homes is political because we must politicize where we live. So I felt that was very critical in my analysis and working from my perspective as in the position I'm in to also try to destroy a lot of capitalist patriarchy is to recognize that it's not just one fine box of what the struggle against sexism is going to be. It's not going to be defined by one kind of woman or any ethnicity, one ethnicity of woman, or even just one role for a woman to relinquish and take on, as opposed to honoring the holistic struggle. And the last quote I'm going to leave with on this section was that one of the main things also was that women should be considered socially equal, humanly different, and totally free. So. Yeah.
I'm going to say just a few more words about women, women's leadership in the movement. Here you can see a pretty much all women front, and this is indicative of what was really a turning point for the movement recently, where, as Becky talked about, the transnational corporate entities that are controlling a lot of the land and economy all over the world were identified as the targets. And these women led a charge on a citrus farm that was owned by one of these transnational corporations. And so it wasn't about so much, you know, some fat cat who was just letting his fields lay fallow and they were going to reclaim it. It was, no, these people are destroying our culture and our economy and we're going to go take it back. And that actually lost a lot of popular support for the MST, but it really took the conversation around agroecology to another level within the movement. So women are pushing the envelope in a lot of different ways. This is that couple that was dancing that I mentioned earlier in Makarenko camp. And I had just given them a purple bandana from OTF because purple is women's color. And this is a group of folks, trans folks, that I met at the camp too that were very present in a lot of spaces, and I was excited to talk to them and see them out, and also excited to see that there was an article written about them and published on the MST website, because sexuality is something that has not been talked about very much in the movement. When I asked if there was a statement about it, that people who've been organizing for a long time in the movement were like, no. So, yeah, to see these folks featured, like, front and center on their website, written about, is really encouraging, and has been fought for by queer folks in the movement who have been a really big part of it for a long time, and now the time has come to, time's overdue to talk about those issues. I'm going to slide into youth real quick. This was a video to kind of show the high energy of the youth movement. They had their own night where they had the arena all to themselves, and they had a big concert in there. They are pushing the envelope within the movement a lot as well. This is the only time that I have saw anyone masked up in the MST. It's actually pretty frowned upon within the MST. wearing a mask over your face. But the youth were there wearing black bandanas, fists in the air. And they're talking a lot about sexuality, gender, as well as bridging these rural and urban divides. So MST has always been a rural movement. But as Becky talked about, the same folks are being oppressed, and the same concept. I had a spiel that was a lot longer about this, but we're short on time. So I think we all know the drill that class consciousness and solidarity is something that we want to be building in all of our movements all over the world, and the youth are definitely leading the charge on that within the MST. Can we cut off there? We'll move on to education. Becca got a lot to say about education.
No, this is her specialty. So before I start my dissertations on the MST in education, I could talk for a long time. But I'm actually going to cut my presentation and talk really short. And I can, if you want to talk more about it, we can talk afterwards, and I can send you articles I've written. So anyway, the MST invests a lot in education. And the MST thinks of education in three different ways. They think of informal education, non-formal education, and formal education. So informal education is every single organizing space in a movement. The MST tries to think of every social movement space as being an intentional space where you have to think through the type of educational experience you want people to have, whether it's a meeting, whether it's the organization of houses on a settlement, whether it's milking the cows. What is the type of educational experience you want people to have informally? And the MST is very intentional about that. The second thing is non-formal education. This is huge. This is non-formal education would be the courses, classes, or programs that are not sanctioned by the Brazilian government and do not lead to diplomas. However, these are the courses that are focused on understanding the history of agrarian struggles, political theory, and the contemporary context. The MST has several schools across the country. This happens to be their national school, the National School Florestan Fernandes. And this school has courses every year, all the time, for not only Brazilians, but for activists across Latin America. I'm just going to give this list. Just in 2011, they had a course on political theory for leaders of the MST, 40 days, twice a year. A course for all social movement leaders in Brazil, 40 days, three times a year. They had a Marxist theory course, once a week, six times a year. A course on Florestan Fernandes, who's another theorist, once a week, six times a year. They had a Latin American political theory course for 40 days with 60 to 80 participants across Latin America who came to this school to study together. And they had another Latin America political theory course that was 3 months with 70 to 100 participants from 20 countries around Latin America. Everyone came together to this school to study together. So you see the MST in this non-formal education, in this non-formal, non-state-sanctioned education, is a leader in Latin America. They're bringing hundreds and hundreds of activists, including some Latinos from the United States, went a few years in a row. They bring all these activists to Brazil to study together in 3 months and really study political theory. So this is incredibly important. The third area is public education. I was going to read this quote, but I'll just move on. Basically, you could ask the question, why does the MST bother with public education? They have their own educational spaces, and we know how can you possibly promote a socialist education model before a socialist revolution, right? That would be the question. But the MST doesn't see it that way. They see every public institution, including public schools, as terrains of contestation that they have to occupy in addition to occupying land. And so the MST has really tried to occupy the public school system and implement alternative pedagogies in this public school system as well. So they've gained lots of schools. Thousands of schools, thousands of teachers. They've had thousands of courses. Keep going. But one of the most exciting things I just have to stop and say is that after that massacre in 1996, 2 years later, the president was actually forced to create a program called the Program for Education and Agrarian Reform. And the MST over the past decade has used this program to partner with universities to give their activists in areas of agrarian reform access to university education. So over the past decade, 14,000 activists from different social movements, mostly from the MST, have gotten college degrees in pedagogy and veterinary studies and history and sociology. And this, just last year, was the first this was a graduate course of the MSC's first course in law that they created in partnership with a federal university. And right there you see all MST militants, activists who just got their law degree, and most of them are going to go back within the movement and be lawyers for the movement. So this access is very interesting. Yeah. I'm not going to go over this right now, but the MST doesn't just want access, they also want to create an alternative curricular and organizational space within these schools, and they have a whole set of proposals that they're trying to do for curriculum and for the type of organization they want in these schools. So if you're interested, I can talk more. But they have an entire pedagogical proposal for these educational spaces. Let's flip through. And just finally, while we were at the Congress, we actually got to see firsthand the MSC's interaction with the public educational sphere. When on Wednesday morning, the MSC brought 500, what they call Sentejina, or little landless ones, the little children who are the sons and daughters of the parents who live in settlements. They brought them all to the Ministry of Education for the day in buses. And in the morning, there were some MSC activists that were standing by the door, sort of waiting. And as soon as the first bus of kids arrived, they ran out of the bus, and these activists held the doors open. And all the kids went into the Ministry of Education, and they were shouting about the right to have rural education. The problem in Brazil is that a big trend is to close rural schools and put them in urban areas. And over the past 5 years, about 37,000 rural schools have been closed in Brazil. And so you can see in the next slide, the little kids having to sign more than 37 million schools in the countryside closed were fighting against this. And so they continued fighting. You can continue. And so, stop there. After 3 hours, the Minister of Education finally came down to the kids to talk to them. And he came down and he said, "Oh, we're so happy you're here." Don't know why it took him 3 hours to come down. "But we're so happy we're here. And believe us, the federal government is dedicated to rural education. We're dedicated to providing quality schools in rural areas." And so the MST says that's great, but we know that the MST will only... The MSC knows this will only ever happen if the children themselves keep taking to the streets. And here you have a little landless one, Sintahinia, that's putting her mark in the Ministry of Education, and she has a little sign that says, little landless ones in struggle. So that's a very rapid educational summary, but I can talk more with anyone after the presentation.
Cool. So one of the most exciting moments of the Congress was when everyone took to the streets. The kids led the way, and then everybody else followed it later on in the day. 15,000 people in the streets. It was a huge march. You couldn't see from one end to the other. And it was a really good example of the diversity within the movement. We heard whispers the night before the march that the leadership was still debating about what was going to happen on the march when they got to the presidential offices. And so everyone was really excited to see what would transpire and what the day would hold.
So there was a consistent theme throughout the march, a police presence, which, though trying to be intimidating, as you can see in the picture here, were severely outnumbered. It was about maybe 200 to 300 police officers who, for the majority of the march, stayed to the outskirts, didn't necessarily harass the people along the way. But during the course of the march, there were different stops. People would give speeches, talk about a few different things. And eventually, we ended up at the presidential palace, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. The presidential palace, where the action was to continue politicizing the march, but also there was a particular demonstration where some people were going to bring some crosses, you know, to represent the symbolism of struggle through the Catholic Church, and set them up on the lawn over here where we were at in the presidential palace. And it was actually, first, when the people got there, they had barricades already set up for the people not to be able to get to the place where we were obviously heading to. People pushed through the barricades, were pepper sprayed, and after that, when the truck bed that was bringing the crosses through was actually blocked by a row of police who stood in front of it. And because of that, the people got a little angry, and this happened. Next slide. This happened. So the police officers, after blocking the the crosses began to be on the run, the people actually took the crosses and started throwing them at the police, as well as a bunch of, and then that's one of the papers that shows more pictures of it specifically. And this was an interesting thing to see because it's particularly with organizing here in the States, when it gets ugly and confrontations happen with the police, oftentimes the activists were the ones on the run. This is not the case here. The 200 or 300 police were scared to death of the 15,000 people and started to shoot off tear gas. They lined up in formation here to recover some of their wounded, shot tear gas indiscriminately at women, children, after blocking them from, you know, setting up the crosses, and eventually dispersed out of the middle of the march to the outskirts, and then the march continued to the next section of the lawn. So that was a particularly interesting phenomenon for me to witness, that the power of mass mobilization can actually do in comparison to some of the experiences some of us have had here in the United States organizing against police terrorism and, you know, the governmental oppression in general. This brother right here is Marcio Barreto. Barreto. He is a MST militant for the Front of the Masses, which oftentimes when they do occupations, some of the very disciplined members go out and scope out the land to see. Sometimes the landowners have private guards who are ruthless. Sometimes there's a bunch of other stuff that they have to check out to make sure it's safe for the rest of the movement to come in and occupy. So this brother actually talked a lot about the criminalization of political organizing. He's a political prisoner multiple times throughout the course of him organizing with the MST. He said in 1995, 1997, 1998, 2001, each time he was detained or arrested and in jail for a couple of months, adding up to about 6 or 7 months total. So I did an interview with him that Becky translated and Effie took notes on the criminalization of political organizing. So I'm going to read it really quickly because we're running low on time. What was the reason that the state gave you for your incarceration, and what is your opinion of why you were incarcerated? He said he was accused of stealing, formation of a guerrilla group, and invasion of land. The MST does not feel it's a crime to occupy. Much of the land they occupy was stolen by the quote-unquote owners in the first place. The MST feels land is a right and occupation, an act that is constitutionally protected. What are the dynamics like inside prison with the guards, racial tensions? The people inside are usually poor and black. Sound familiar? Because most folks in that demographic don't have access to lawyers. His case was different, though, because the MST gave him legal support. And when you're in direct confrontation with the police, it's a different story. Those situations are very dangerous, sometimes for the police, as you saw in the last slide. Those situations are very dangerous. But inside is different, because the guards know there's a lot of support outside. Sometimes there's an event, there's even politicians visiting the MST prisoners, so the guards are on their best behavior, which is something that I'm sure that the thousands of brothers who starved themselves during the hunger strike would definitely benefit from and see as something that's very different. But I thought that was interesting. When an MST militant is inside, other prisoners respect them and even protect them. That's very different than how a person convicted of rape is treated, for example. I asked, is there any coordinated prison organizing going on in the MST? The MST doesn't officially do that kind of organizing, but often gets accused of it when it happens. For example, in 97 or 98, some comrades came and camped outside the prison, and the prisoners were throwing food outside to the camping comrades. Number five, any advice for those who may be doing time? I always say you can't put your head down. The police are going to tell you you're a criminal, but you're not. You're a militant and you're doing what's right. So I just thought that was interesting to share because a lot of similar struggles involving police and prisons, there's a lot of similarities with our struggle going on over here, but particularly that the politicians were visiting him, that the guards were on their best behavior, particularly for the militant organizers, which is a radical difference than what I know of the organizing that goes on over here with people being targeted for their political beliefs and being sent to the chute for over 20, 25 years because of their political organizing and oftentimes getting forgotten about by activists outside here. I also wanted to share that, without going into as many details, a lot of people, when organizing and traveling different places, receive quote-unquote extra random screening. And I've went through that for about the past 4 years. On the way into Brazil, I was detained for about 30 to 40 minutes. The federal police pulled me out of line when I was showing my passport and decided to look through my stuff and found my MST packet, the hotel that I was staying, or the hostel that I was supposed to stay at, documented it all, and then let me go. And then on the way back into the States, upon getting to LAX, U.S. Customs agents interviewed me, or really just tried to get me to incriminate myself for about 2 to 3 hours while taking all of my belongings out and searching them. So it's obvious that some people are coordinating about not wanting the MST to link up with solidarity with people across the world, especially particularly people inside the United States. And I also heard while I was being detained at LAX, the captain who was in charge, I guess, at the time, mentioning to somebody that they had a few Cuban nationals detained as well, you know. So, yeah, it's to be expected, though. I say this just for people who might be new to organizing or also might not necessarily have a more thorough study of the tactics that, you know, the capitalists use against those that want to resist. These are intimidation tactics as well as, you know, trying to control the energy of people who are organizing. So, yeah.
So I'm just going to say a few words about what's happening with the urban movement within the MST, because as we've talked about, it's very much been traditionally a rural movement, and is now doing things like this, which is the very first settlement, Comuna Urbana. So you can see there's many houses and people built them themselves. This is a camp that's going on. So just on the other side of those sticks, they put those sticks up as kind of a first defense to stop people coming in. On the other side, if you want to go to, you can see the MST flag flying there too. On the other side, there's a long hill and all the little shacks set up with the black tarp that's kind of iconic of the MST movement. This is in Sao Paulo. Thank you. which is one of the largest cities in Brazil. You can see in that last photo that they've siphoned off electricity. They've got a really good system. It's called a gata, like cat, where they siphon off power so that they can have it in their homes. So they've got little fridges in there and the whole thing. This gentleman, his name meant drummer, and he has been involved for decades and decades in many different camps. He's there providing some child care for a young mother so she could go out and get some errands done. But just to say, like, you know, there's people that this is their life. They go from their, as militants, go from camp to camp just doing everything from watching the babies to providing political education. This is another family. You can see the number 70, which indicates the núcleo that they're a part of. Go to the next one. And again, there's some of those lines and infrastructure that people have set up. These two that are facing the camera are some of the militants for that camp. Young people look a lot like us. The guy on the right is an MST militant, and I will put this photo in because the two on the left are organizers of Pasa Livre, which is the free transportation movement in Brazil that has made a lot of news and waves and awesome impact within Brazil. And these three folks, they get together and talk about politics all the time and share strategies and debate. You know, if you ask someone, like we heard from some of the older organizers in the movement at the Congress, a real dismissal of Pasa Livre as something that just didn't have longevity or teeth or any sort of maturity. They often do, MST organizers that have been around for a long time often do dismiss some of the more for simplicity's sake, I'll say anarchist organizing that happens within Brazil as naive, and then those organizers will dismiss the MST as sold out to the state, right? But the people that are actually on the ground are doing a lot of co-learning from each other and discussion. I just wanted to demonstrate that.
Also real quick, because we are a little bit over time, I did get a lot of interest from people there about the Black Riders Liberation Party as the new generation Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. I learned that Erica Huggins, former Panther and head of the Oakland Community School, was out there some years ago and did educational workshops and a lot of building. And I actually did an interview with was actually in one of the papers in regards to the Black Riders. They got the headline, every 28 hours a black person is murdered, says Black Riders. But so there was also a question of race consistently. So I heard from some people that race in Brazil is a lot more advanced. It's not as racist as other places. And then I heard from other people that that's just liberal hogwash, and that people are pretty much covering over what's happening. And that race is ever just as prevalent here in Brazil as it is anywhere else, and that racism oftentimes is one of the main fuelers and functioneers of capitalism, and it keeps it going like almost no other pillar that's involved in capitalism. So that's just, I can talk a little bit more about that, after we finish the presentation, but I just wanted to share that with you.
And one of our last topics is just internationalism. We just want to point out that although the MST is a Brazilian social movement, internationalism is a huge part of its struggle. It is part of Via Campesina, which is an international network of over 130 organizations of 70 countries that try to bring together peasant and farming struggles. It also supports a lot of other struggles. It has brigades of MST activists that go to other countries and support those other countries. There's brigades of MST activists in Palestine, in Honduras after the coup, in Cuba, in Mozambique, in Venezuela. And so the MST has tons and tons of people they send all around the world to support other urban and rural struggles. And they also really respect, if you get over, there was a delegation of 250 people from 29 different countries that were international at the Congress, and they treated us like queens and kings, and nothing was paid for. Everything was paid for. They gave us, the nice hotels. Even though everyone was sleeping in tents, we had, nice areas. We had, extra good food. I mean, they really respect international delegates, and they really respect their international solidarity networks, especially their international delegates from Haiti and from Cuba have a special sort of role. And when we had an international night, actually, where everyone came together to celebrate internationalism, the Haitians and the Cuban delegates were the ones who were able to speak. And every flag was present everywhere except the U.S. flag. We were okay with that. And then, should I introduce this transition real
quick? Yeah.
So now we're transitioning now into a period of sort of questions and answers and suggestions. And so we're hoping that we can clarify questions, but we're also hoping that we can talk about what the MST can do for us. And so Shango and Effie are both going to talk a little bit about what the MST actually means for U.S. social movements. And so Effie's just going to do that real quick.
Okay, you got it.
I just wanted to remind people that after this, we are going to have a musical performance, hip hop, also some, some rock bands and
Latin music.
So stay tuned, because you're going to get something to be able to move your feet to.
Right on. So last time we presented at Quilombo, some folks gave us some feedback, this is really cool and really interesting, but we'd like to hear a little bit more analysis of how this relates to us and what we're doing. That's for each of us to kind of determine ourselves and think about ourselves, but I thought I'd share a couple things that really stood out to me. One was that the structure that I showed you a moment ago with all the little colorful circles, it demonstrates that there is some pretty rigorous internal discussion and debate and accountability from the grassroots to the national level, so that the strategy is coming from these small groups at the ground level, and that everybody is engaged in it. Everybody's talking about what's happening at the national level. They feel that they're having a say, and that it's important to them. And that is a long-term commitment. The preparation for the national congress that we attended was 2 years of committed focus within the camps and settlements discussing these topics. Another thing that really impressed me was the dedication to political formation. So the militants, the organizers, are often spending years of time and energy in getting versed in philosophy and some of the literature and history, and are able to offer political education, formación, as part of the actions that they do. So in the 2 months leading up to an occupation, they'll offer kind of classes with titles like Why Horizontalism? Why Occupation? How Society Works? And these are things that they do beforehand, but really the heart of their formación happens during an action, because they see it as a crucible of political growth. So when people are engaged in an action themselves, a couple of days can be equivalent to a couple of years of study from books. So they really focus on that formación that happens right in tandem with taking direct action. And personally, I'd really like to see a lot of rigorous thought and energy go into that sort of formación for the organizing that we do day to day. I think the last thing that I'll say, because I think it's really directly related to how this delegation formed, was that photo that I showed you of the Pasa Libre organizers and the MST organizer, that there's some really important cross-pollination happening within their movements as individuals, as in personal relationships. And Shango and I are part of something called a new thing called the Intercommunal Solidarity Committee, and that's how we started to get to know each other. And this is a space where people can talk to one another that are organizing in completely different political spaces, or perhaps the same geographical space, and have a place where we can call each other in instead of calling each other out, like on Facebook or just talking shit to somebody else. This is a place where you can say, hey, you did that, and that was messed up because of this, and we're going to do it in a principled way. We're going to talk to each other in a principled way, and we're going to learn together. And we're committed to that, and we're accountable to each other. So I saw that happening within the urban movement of the MST, and that's something that I really feel a lot of strength and confidence in continue to put energy in here, and hope to see other people in affinity groups doing that as well.
What's that called again?
What?
You just said the
Intercommunal Solidarity Committee. I'm happy to talk to anybody else about that.
Yeah, just a little background history of our theoretical framework for developing the Intercommunal Solidarity Committee. It comes from our study of the original Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. As we know, it was labeled by the FBI COINTELPRO as a black hate extremist group. Bobby Seale oftentimes said, you don't fight racism with racism, you fight with solidarity. Of course, understanding now that we understand that we don't have the power to be racist yet, it's important to build principled unity with all people who are actively sincere in crushing capitalism, imperialism, racism, and sexism. From, like Effie said, a principled standpoint, not on a kumbaya, we're all in this together, we are the 99% with no divisions and things like that, but actually addressing differences and being able to maintain those differences being able to address those differences before the state exploits them and says, okay, well, you believe this and they believe that, so insert agent provocateur here, and the movement is fractured and weak. You know, so it comes from the study of the original Black Panther Party's developing the National Coalition to Combat Fascism, which came from the Constitutional the Convention to Combat Fascism in Berkeley in 1970, where the Panther Party not only generated solidarity with anti-imperialist whites, but Chicanos, and it also helped emphasize the Rainbow Coalition that Fred Hampton Sr. started, which basically called for all people who were struggling to share in their common fight against a common enemy, not to act like the dynamics were equally the same or in the same range, but to understand that we're in different ways still getting oppressed by the same beast. So in that vein, we take the Intercommunal Solidarity Committee. It was developed in our Los Angeles chapter first, and we recently started organizing a chapter out here with our initiatives for the Break the Lock campaign, which is a prisoner support campaign, really an honor inspired by the hunger strikers, who were the first to call for an end to racial hostilities while being behind prison lines. And if anybody knows anybody who's been to prison, the racial divisions in prison, which are exacerbated by the guards and the administration of the state, are very hard to be able to unify within. Yet these brothers were able to say, okay, from those conditions, we can sit at the table and put our differences to the side to find where we have common ground, and then we can address these differences within our own house. So the calling in, the constructive criticism that we have, we're trying to develop within the ISC, the Intercommunal Solidarity Committee, I think also ties largely into the MST's support of international solidarity. You know, so just we can talk more about that as well. Some members are here, and we can go into more detail, but we just wanted to share that with you.
Okay. We're going to transition, not really going to transition to questions and suggestions. I just want to say that there's a network of Friends of the MST committees in North America and Europe. And traditionally, this has been a network of solidarity organizations with the MST. So when the massacre happened in 1996, the U.S. Friends of the MST went to the Brazilian embassy, went to the U.S. embassy, wrote letters. They were in solidarity with the MST. After the Congress, there was a meeting, a strategy meeting between the MST leadership and these Friends of the MST committees, and there was an acknowledgement that, wow, the MST is much better organized than the grassroots movements in Europe and the United States. And that's not good for the MST, because if the MST really wanted to have some kind of socialist experiment in Brazil, the United States would be the first one to stop that, right? So the MST is very invested in helping our social movements in the United States and in Europe grow. And so we wanted to transition now into, you can ask questions about the presentation, but really a discussion of what do you want from the MST? You just learned a lot about the MST. If you're connected to grassroots movements here, how would you find, what kind of support could the MST give our movements here? Because that's really the request. They're really asking how they can help our movements here. And not everyone's going to be able to talk, because a lot of people will, though, because everyone's going to keep their comments to like 20 seconds, 30 seconds. But I'm going to hand out note cards, and there's a bunch of Friends of the MST committee members here. We're going to take these note cards, and we're going to try to think through how we can keep building connections between the MSTs and between U.S. social movements to try to figure out how we can build a global struggle to actually transform economic, social, racial, gender, sexual inequalities.
That's all.
Yeah. So, Shango's going to facilitate the question answer discussion section. I'm passing out these note cards. Please get these back to me with suggestions. Charlotte, we're going to read through them seriously. Yeah. So that's the presentation.
With this question and answer, like we said, we still got the tools to get to, which, like I said earlier, if you was listening, culture is important. So, you know, don't hate on the music, which is going to inevitably come. And let's try to keep our questions that we're sharing here, because, of course, we're going to have more time for dialogue on a more intimate, personal level. But let's try to keep the questions or comments to 20 or 30 seconds, and we'll try to keep the responses the same, because we want to set up the music in about 10 minutes at the most. So, Yes, ma'am. Charlotte.
Great presentation. Really good. I just wanted to say that on the table over here, there's a sign-up sheet that you can sign up to get the newsletter that comes out from the Friends of the MST with updates about what the MST and Friends of the MST are doing. So if you're interested, please be sure to sign up on there.
I was curious if you could talk a little bit about the support networks in the pre-settlement stage. I understand once they win this land, then it becomes about how to work that land. But you know, when these people are isolated and constantly getting picked off, do they have support networks that are sending them food and supplies? Do they have, you know, do they just start tilling the land that they're on right there? How do the pre-settlements stay supported long enough to go?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that, and Becky can fill in because she's got a lot more experience than I do. But there's a government program that Becky mentioned, Bolsa Familia, which sends, I don't know if it's literal food baskets. Yeah, it's literal food baskets to people that need them, including people that are in the middle of an occupation. But sometimes when they discover that people are in an occupation, they might cut them off, especially if the local agribusinesses start elbowing them to do so. In which case, sometimes a lot of organizers or people within the camp need to find jobs outside of the camp. And so then the camp will be held down by a crew that can do so. And everyone pays in dues as well. Like, everyone pays in dues. So people that are there 24/7 will pay, like, a fraction. Like, if someone who's staying in the camp 24/7 pays $10, someone who's going out and working will pay $35. And so they fund themselves that way as well as growing their own food. Am I missing anything? That's kind of like, how are they feeding themselves? But there's also, like, legal support that the MST provides and things like that, too.
Yeah, if you go to, like, if you participate in an MST land occupation, there'll be, like, 30 experienced militants, activists that will help the occupation actually happen, and they'll bring people from the camps. They'll bring people from, like, urban areas and from rural areas to do the occupation, and then these 30 activists, militants, will stay with the camp for, like, 3 or 4 weeks to try to get the structure of the camp up. But the MST's phrase is that everyone needs to learn how to coordinate and be coordinated. And so these MST activists take this coordination role, try to set up the structure of the camp, but the hope is that the internal structure builds so people can coordinate themselves. And then those MST activists sort of drift off into their own camps, their own settlements, and the idea is that new leaders arise in those camps that are going to autonomously run the camps. But there's always initially, there's a huge support network of MST activists in all the camps, in the pre-settlements, in states where the MST is strong. We actually went to some settlements and some camps where the MST is not very strong, and so they didn't have enough activists to send. But hypothetically, you have experienced activists that are helping set up the settlement and the camp and the pre-settlements in those areas. And you having people get sent to political training classes as soon as they sort of show leadership potential. Yeah.
The glasses, yes.
Or maybe we'll sit with that suggestion. We've been talking a lot, so maybe we'll allow like 5 or 6 people to like sort of comment and suggest, and then if there's questions for us, we'll respond after that. Does that make sense?
Maybe like two or three.
I think one of the things that is not that most people in the U.S., most people outside of Brazil don't have an awareness of right now are some of the huge injustices going on in preparation for the upcoming World Cup and Olympics. Major human rights abuses, the waste of public funds, the billions of dollars being spent on stadiums and new subways when that money should be spent on new hospitals and like education projects and things like that. I was just wondering what sorts of things is the MST, was there any dialogue while you're there about how the MST has been involved? I know there's been a huge resurgence of civil society in Brazil in the past few years, especially in the last year or so. I was wondering if that was something that you overheard while you were there in the MST discussions and how to fight these injustices going on in preparation for these events.
Yeah, I know lots of MST activists who are involved in anti-World Cup organizing and who are sort of in the way that Effie talked about on their own connecting with other urban groups that are anti-World Cup organizing, right? The MST as like an official organization, they've condemned the World Cup spending, but they're not actively organizing around it. I even heard like the leader of the MST sort of say offhand that it's probably a bad idea to organize a protest during soccer games, given that every single Brazilian is going to be at a bar watching soccer. So there might be at the leadership level some sort of disregard of the anti-World Cup organizing, but at the local activist level, I know lots of people who are involved in that organizing as well. There's lots of connections. There's lots of MST activists who join other movements, and there's lots of fluidity with these movements in Brazil.
So you were saying that only about 10% of occupations are successful, so I was wondering if the MST has identified some common characteristics to successful occupation, and if any of that is transferable to the or conversely, any failure, any common things among the failures.
Mm-hmm. You know, unfortunately, the most success, maybe Charlotte, if she left. The most successful land occupations happened right after that massacre in 1996, when the Brazilian government was so embarrassed that it had shot down 19 people in a crowd that it was sort of forced to redistribute all of this land. So a lot of times, the success of the MST's land occupation sort of depend on the sort of the political moment and the political conjuncture. But it also depends on people being able to stay on the land for more than, these are 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And so if you don't organize a successful occupation, then you're not going to get the land. And so maybe I could twist your question a little and not making success getting the land, but making success having a vibrant camp. And I think a big part of vibrant camps is having youth activities, having cultural activities, having soccer games, having the camp become your life, right? Because camps can be there. We spent one night there. It was tiring, right? It's tiring. It's a hard life. So figuring out ways to keep people engaged and keep community, those would be some of the first things that come off the top of my head. But success itself in getting the land is often like this greater political economic context.
And I would just add that what hit me the most about what guarantees success for an MST occupation is commitment. Like, it takes 5 years, at least, and that's ideally.
Yeah. Last question right here, you, sir.
You were talking a little bit about the solidarity between struggles in urban areas and also rural areas, and people working in cities, factory workers, and also agricultural workers, and folks working on even some fiscal plots. And they're both working to petition the state for the right to a decent standard of living. Are there any direct relationships between those groups in cities and the rural areas, aside from both petitioning the state, or is it just kind of joint actions? Are there exchanges of goods or anything like that?
Are we taking 3 questions at a time? Is that I broke my own rule. You want to take 2 more questions, and then we'll answer that one also. Sure.
Yeah, we can. So wait, what?
Want to take 2 more questions and then we'll answer all of them?
Sure. So can we, yeah.
So somewhat related, thinking about this relationship between the rural and urban, and I'm just wondering, you know, because you were pointing to the fact that they are starting to do more work in an urban setting now, and whether being able to do that has in some way depended on having grown to such a large movement, which happened like this for reclaiming land. And I'm wondering, you know, what lessons they've been learning as they've started to try to do this work in urban settings as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question to take back to the MST. Like, we want to know more about your urban struggles and how you're connecting to urban struggles. And the question here was about petitions and urban struggles there?
No, I think it was mostly about how urban and rural are working together. Chris, do you want to summarize it real quick? So we were going to take one more, and then maybe that's the last round of questions.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of land, go ahead and pass those around, Christoph. Great.
Yeah. I'm going to pass these around the room, and I want to invite you all. You've all heard a report back about the MST, and you're all about to get some music. This April 26th, which is, what, 10 days? Or less than 10 days from today, 9 days, you can, and we're inviting you from Occupy the Farm and Gilltrack Farm Coalition to come put your hands in some dirt that was actually won for community farming by an occupation, very much inspired by the MST that began the relationship between Occupy the Farm and the MST that has a lot to do with this delegation and this report back that you're sitting through right now. So the Gilltrack is a 20-acre urban farmland owned by UC Berkeley, and we stopped them 2 years ago with the occupation. We stopped them from developing that land. That fight is ongoing. They still want to develop it, and it's been a 2-year campaign thus far, and we've had a lot of victories, a lot of concrete victories, and one of those victories is that 1.5 acres of that land has already been set aside for community agriculture, for community farming. That means all of you. That's all our land. That's all your land. And on April 26th, you can all go put your hands in the dirt and start playing that land and growing food on that land for our community. So that's there.
Ryan, last question.
Yeah, I just want to announce that as we're transitioning into music, we have a raffle going on over here to support paying for the trip that already happened, and anything over that will just go towards helping to coordinate this ongoing communication and collaboration between Occupy the Farm and the Black Riders Liberation Party and local groups here at MST. We're also giving away hats and t-shirts and things for donations, so if you want to come grab a flag or a hat, a t-shirt, or a CD, we're accepting donations to go towards that same thing. Thanks. And I guess I will make a comment, which is just that kind of really interesting. The start of the story was about how this direct action land reclamation led to a landowner actually giving away this land to becoming a settlement, and it seems like there's a real intersection there. So I'm curious about the intersectionality of voluntary gifting, redistribution, reallocation of land, and direct action to reclaim land, how those things come together and how we can welcome that voluntary shift while also keeping our teeth and moving forward in direct action.
Mm. Brooke, did you have an announcement too?
Just similarly to visit the table and further down that some of the bandanas that you've been seeing in the clips are on this table, and they're our fundraiser for Occupy the Farm, so out in style when you come out on the
26th. Woo! Cool. Any quick comments in response to the questions?
I mean, in response to that, yes, the answer is yes. There's lots and lots of connections, lots and more connections between the MST and urban areas, and there has to be because MST youth are actually, some of them stay in rural areas and some of them leave. A lot of them want to go to the cities but still be connected to the movement. And so these connections are getting greater and greater and greater as the MST is getting older. And it sounds like from Cecilia's question that maybe that's one thing that we can ask the MST about is how are they moving into urban areas? How are they facing that organizing? Because in the United States, urban organizing is central central political organizing because we only have 2% of our population in rural areas now, right? So the answer is yes, and maybe that's what we'll go back with the MST with, that we're really interested in that aspect of the movement.
I also had an announcement. We have a table over here where we're raising funds specifically for our comrade Jihad Mujahid Muhammad, who was formerly, recently a political prisoner, who was arrested and incarcerated on Lavelle Mixon Day. He was supposed to be released the following year, and mysteriously a warrant for a supposed burglary that was allegedly done 2 years ago was put out for him. He was cotton swabbed and actually transferred to Santa Clara County. Recently, through the support of the people, we were able to bail him out, but he still has funds to have to pay for that bail, as well as we're raising money for legal fees so he's not trumped up. And the reason why Jihad was targeted is because the Black Riders Liberation Party puts heavy emphasis on transforming some of the most self-destructive, genocidal black youth who are out there in the community who otherwise would be committing illegitimate capitalism into being a revolutionary force. And brother, our Minister of Spiritual Affairs, Comrade Jihad Mujahid Muhammad, is a major factor in that. As a former participant in self-genocide, like a lot of us, who's committed his life to revolutionary struggle. He was a hunger strike participant while he was at San Quentin. They helped organize the pod workers to do what we call watch pigs, when you observe the police to make sure they're not doing any illegal activity. When they would raid cells of hunger strike participants, the pod workers observed the COs to make sure they didn't plant any contraband or anything on the hunger strikers to discredit their movement. So he was a part of that, and because of it, he's been specifically targeted since he got out. He had instructions to help support the brothers that are still inside, so he needs funds and support. We got a lot of music, oils, different things over here, so please, if y'all could check that out as well, you know, that would be dope. But with that, I just want to know, basically, how many people here love good music? By a round of applause. Yeah. How many people love hip-hop? By a round of applause. I'm not trying to be hip-hop biased, but I love hip-hop. I really love hip-hop. Y'all love hip-hop like I love hip-hop. When I ask you that question again, I think you might maybe have a little flashback to when I told y'all the instructions on when I say all power to the people. Okay, a couple people ready. The rest of y'all sleep. How many people love hip hop?
Yeah!
So basically, that was a smooth transition. We're gonna share some tunes with y'all about some real revolutionary conscious hip hop. Actually, a part of our program is to prevent the suppression of conscious hip hop, because we saw as black people that the black spirituals and different forms of culture helped inspire in the most repressive, oppressive conditions. I got my brethren on the ones and twos over there with his laptop, Itel Rock. He gonna help us get this thing smoking. So if y'all really ready to get some of this good revolutionary culture, let me hear y'all make some noise. Did y'all enjoy the presentation? Let me hear you make some noise.